Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey, what's up? My name is Nolan. I am from Pass Gas by Donut. We are the world's number one automotive podcast. And this week, it's part two of our series on Saab, the legendary and now dead Swedish automaker. What happens when a Swedish company known for its quirky cars is bought by an enormous American manufacturer? Well, it means the death knell for that small, cute little Swedish company. That's right. If you like Saab, if you like GM, or if you just want to hear a great automotive story, check out Past Gas by Donut, again, the world's number one automotive podcast.
In 2017, Austrian Formula One legend Niki Lauda claimed in an interview that he had no friends. 2 years later, he died at the age of 70 of kidney failure, and the tributes poured in. Lewis Hamilton wrote, quote, "I will miss our conversations, our laughs, the big hugs after winning races together. Love you, man." His ex-wife Marlena, note the ex, said of Niki that during his racing career, he was, quote, "the biggest asshole in the world." When confronted with her words, Niki agreed, saying, quote, "she was completely correct." On the track, British playboy James Hunt was famously Niki's greatest rival, dramatized in the Ron Howard film Rush. Their teams, McLaren and Ferrari, openly loathed each other. And yet, the two drivers had shared an apartment during their Formula 3 days. While Niki refused to call anyone his friend, including James, he also said James was, quote, "someone he'd have a beer with." What else can you call that but a friend? On race day, Niki Lauda was known as a steely-eyed Austrian with a killer mindset. Perhaps it's no coincidence that his most famous compatriot is known around the world as the Terminator. Yet Niki's most famous moment was a horrific crash at a Nürburgring that left him permanently scarred, showing that he was not a Terminator at all. He was flesh and bone, just like everyone else. Widely considered to be the first truly technical driver in F1, Niki's greatest moment was not a lap time or a racing win. It was his choice to return to racing weeks after his accident, a moment of pure heart. There's an impulse in life to put people and their personalities into neat boxes, to categorize them as likable or unlikable, brave or cowardly, heroes or villains. How did Niki Lauda defy those categories? What about the showdown in Niki's own body between his head and his heart? His logic and his life force, a man of steel and a man of blood and flesh. Today on Pass Gas, it's Niki Lauda and the contradictions that made him human.
Pass Gas Podcast. It's about cars, it's not about sports.
That's a fire intro.
Great intro, everyone. All right, good job out there, everybody. Good job, Nolan.
Great job.
Welcome to Pass Gas. I'm your host, Nolan Sykes, joined as always by my co-hosts, James Pumphrey.
What's up, Pass Gas guys?
And Joe Weber.
What's up, Wink Wink Nation? I'm here for you guys. I don't want to do the other one because out of respect for Niki Lauda and the thing that he went through.
Well, it's very courteous of you, Joe. Good thinking. Today we're talking about one of my favorite drivers, I would say. Niki Lauda, he sadly passed away in 2019, at the age of 70 years old, very young, too soon. And now we think it's finally time for us to cover his story on the show. I think we've got a very, it'll be a jam packed episode for you guys. He lived a very incredible life and just one of those unique personalities that stood out in Formula One.
I'm going to be honest. I don't know too much about his life other than what I saw in Rush.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that the actor who played Niki Lauda seemed like he was doing a gold member impression.
Daniel Brühl.
Yeah.
Great actor.
It came off as a little gold member-y. I do want to watch a couple interviews with Niki Lauda and see if he was similar to Gold Member or if he was not like Gold Member at all. If he eats skin from a little box.
I don't think he ate skin flakes from a little box.
If
like
he
Gold
smokes
Member.
While he's eating. That's a weird joke to have in kind of a kid's movie. Like the smoking while you're eating thing. You know, like smoking a pancake and bonging a blintz and all that stuff.
I haven't seen Gold Member in maybe 15 years at this point. So yeah. I don't remember. I do remember smoking a pancake.
Yeah.
Do you think Austin Powers is a kid's movie?
There's lots of duty in it. Remember that duty in the coffee mug thing? That was gross.
That was really gross.
It's a bit nutty.
Like, it's very like juvenile. It's not for kids, but it's for 15-year-old boys.
I certainly did enjoy it as a 15-year-old boy. That's for sure.
And I'll go on record saying Goldmember, the third Austin Powers movie, is the best Austin Powers movie.
The one with Beyonce?
Yeah.
Huh.
Fight me in the comments. I don't care. I have nothing to lose.
Literally nothing to lose in this
argument. Nothing to lose.
I'm happy to be here with you guys talking. It's always a good day on Past Gas.
Well, now I'm fired up. Can we get back into this?
Let's get back into it. How? I think we're ready to get into the story of one Niki Lauda.
Yes, let's
Let's get into it. Let's tell this tragic tale.
Let's go.
It's not. I would say it's inspirational. I wouldn't say it's tragic. He
it's inspirational. Half full.
Yeah, he lived a very full life, I would say.
Yeah, and he didn't let this like incident keep him down. Like, he bounced back so quickly.
Yeah, as we'll see. As we'll see, he had a very interesting attitude about it that I think we can all learn from.
Let's go!
Let's go!
Let's go!
Born in 1949, Niki Lauda grew up an Austrian version of Richie Rich, which in German makes him Reiki Reich? That doesn't sound correct. No, that's incorrect. All right.
Oh my God.
He came from a line of Viennese industrialists that were as well connected as it gets in Europe. His great grandfather Ernst, for example, had been knighted by Austrian Emperor Franz Josef in 1916. My great grandfather definitely was not knighted, so we are positively in different tax brackets.
I'm related to Joe Biden, so he's our king now. So you guys better shape up and start showing me some freaking respect, because my distant cousin Joe is now the king.
Isn't it crazy that the president has my name?
Yeah, dude. So Nolan, looks like you're odd man out. You better show us some respect.
Show us some respect. Respect your elders, all right?
Yeah.
All right. Sure thing. You got it, guys. As you do when your family has massive tracts of private land where you can do whatever you want, Niki learned to drive at age 10 when a cousin would take him out in a small car. Austria's driving age was 18, so it wasn't until Niki was 19 that he got his first car, a Mini Cooper S. Great first car, if you ask
great
me.
Great first car.
Which he would always recall as his favorite car ever. High praise from Niki Lauda. Eventually, he started racing the Mini in hill climbs around Austria until eventually upgrading to a Porsche 911. He proved to be a natural, winning nearly every hill climb he entered. That's awesome.
If you think about it, 911's just the backwards Mini Cooper S. Rear engine, rear wheel drive versus front engine, front wheel drive.
That's what people call them. Oh, yeah. 911? That's a backwards Mini Cooper.
Niki's family, however, they were against him racing. They wanted him to go into the family business, which was banking. Niki's grandfather, the patriarch of the family, was particularly dead set against Niki racing. In Niki's words, they would, quote, all have preferred to see my name in the business section of the newspaper instead of the sports pages.
That's a quote. You can't add
but
something.
I know, but he said that in another interview that I watched.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So, you, Joe.
Hey, show some respect!
It just seemed like you were adding words to his quote.
Yeah, you're right. See, I did. I watched some interviews this morning. All right, so I've got the knowledge.
I trust you.
But encouraged by a supportive relative by the name of Uncle Heinz, Nikki stuck with his racing dream.
Please call me Beans.
Don't listen to your parents, Nikki. You must race. Listen to me, Uncle Beans.
And you know what? We sincerely hope that everyone listening has an Uncle Heinz in their life. Everybody needs something like that that's going to push them to do what they want in their life, you know?
I believe, like, I'm your Uncle Heinz a little bit.
You're my Uncle Beans?
Yeah, I'm your Uncle Beans, buddy.
So with his grandpa, like, being so against it, Nikki, like, used that as motivation to be better. He's like, okay, if my stubborn old grandpa is going to be so against me, they had a big blowout fight where Nikki said, no, I'm not going to do the freaking banking. All right, I'm going to race.
The only numbers I care about are lap times and horsepower numbers, Gramps.
That's right, baby. So he used that as, like, motivation. He's like, well, I'm essentially, like, the black sheep of the family. I better be as good as I possibly can to prove them wrong.
Did they cut him off financially?
You know, I'm not sure. Probably not.
Probably not. Yeah, it takes a lot of money to do F1.
With Uncle Beans' support, wind now blowing at his back, Nikki got his Formula Racing start in Formula V, otherwise known as Formula Volkswagen. If you're not familiar, Formula V was a class of racing that was popular in Central Europe at the time, with a wedge-shaped, snub-nosed car with protruding tires based on the pre-1973 Volkswagen Beetle, minus the distinctive Beetle shape. The cars topped out at 120 miles per hour and came in consumer kits that were relatively affordable for race cars.
You can still actually do Formula V. It's still very popular. It's like the lowest rung of open wheel.
I want to do that.
I would love to do that.
Yeah.
Bet I wouldn't fit in the car. Nikki performed well, and soon he had outgrown Formula V. Huh.
Much like James would.
The next step was Formula 2, but he needed cash to get a shot. Formula 2 was much more expensive. With his silver spoon firmly in place, Nikki got what he needed in 1971. With the help of his family connections, at the age of 22, he secured a 30,000-pound bank loan. That's cool, $600,000 in today's money.
Pretty easy to get banks to work with you when
your parents own a bank.
Your family's in the banking business, yeah.
Yeah.
The cash bought him a spot on the March team for the 1972 season. March was a newer team founded in 1969, nice, by Max Mosley, Alan Reese, Graham Coker, and Rahman Hurd. Together, their names spelled March. Unfortunately, much like an ill-fated garage band, the naming of the team was about as much of a high point as they would experience. And while the team experienced success in producing F2 and F3 cars, they simply didn't have the budget for the elite engineering required for F1. Although Lauda proved himself on the team and was quickly racing their F1 cars in addition to F2, it was a frustrating season for everyone involved. The issue was March's 1972 F1 car. It was an experimental design with a transverse gearbox, meaning the engine's axis was perpendicular to the car. The experiment was a failure. It was, as Nikki put it quite plainly, undrivable. One bright spot was Lauda's teammate, Swedish driver Ronnie Peterson, who was a few years older than Nikki and helped show the younger Austrian driver the ropes. Although they got along, they were opposites on the track. Nikki was already becoming a technical driver, while Ronnie was much more instinctual. The only downside for Nikki was the clear hierarchy on the team. He was forbidden from passing Ronnie during a race. The rule ended up not mattering too much, as the season was a bust for both drivers, with Nikki's best finish a 7th place in South Africa and Ronnie Peterson only making the podium a single time for a 3rd place in Germany.
So I just wanted to add, when Nikki transitioned from Formula 3 and Formula 2 and made the jump to Formula 1, he actually had a bank sponsorship lined up with the bank that had given him the loan. They were going to just give him money this time around and have the bank on the car for more exposure throughout Europe. You know, that's the whole point of sponsorships. But his stubborn old grandpa stepped in. Not. That's Uncle Beans. Uncle Beans is cool. Uncle Heinz is cool.
Uncle Beans, go beat up grandpa.
But grandpa came in. He heard that the bank was going to sponsor him.
And at this point, he's still against Nikki Racing. He steps in and says, no, you're not going to sponsor my grandson because he needs to be in my family business. I'm not going to let him race. So they actually called off the sponsorship, and Nikki had to go get another loan instead of getting it for free.
Can you imagine being so rich that your grandson being a professional athlete is embarrassing?
Like, yeah, that's crazy.
By 1973, Lauda's loan was spent, and so was his relationship with March. Ronnie Peterson left for Lotus, but the best Lauda could manage was a spot on British Racing Motors, or BRM. BRM had been a great team for the past decade, winning 4 Constructors' Cups, but by 73, the team was unable to keep up with the new emerging elites of F1, namely Lotus, Tyrrell, McLaren, and Ferrari. Although Nicky didn't have to pay for his spot on BRM, Lewis Stanley, BRM's stern British leader, wasn't paying for Nicky to drive either. In Nicky's words, if I did a good qualifying run, he'd give me an apple, but that was it. What? That's how you pay horses. Nicky had another disappointing season, struggling with BRM's subpar car. I wonder if he was being like hyperbolic or if like literally the guy would give him an apple.
I'm probably hyperbolic, probably joking. Nicky's a funny guy.
Yeah. Still, Nicky's performance on the track was starting to make people take notice. At the 1973 edition of Monaco, Lauda qualified in a respectable 6th, driving a car the whole field knew to be inferior. During the race, he performed even better, scrapping his way up to 3rd before gearbox failure ended his day. Among those taking notice was a little guy named Enzo Ferrari. The typical meetings behind closed doors took place, and for his 3rd F1 season, Lauda got his dream job. He was invited to race for the grand horsey of them all, Scuderia Ferrari. Nicky had no qualms leaving BRM because he only got paid in apples and not much else. Even his performance at Monaco seemed to have no impact. Still, no money, just apples on apples.
So I'm having a hard time visualizing an instinctual driver versus a technical driver. Nolan, can you explain this to me?
You know, I would think that like an instinctual driver in that time meant that someone just had really great car control and they were just able to like just keep the car on track. Just that natural talent of knowing what the car is going to do and being able to correct. And then a technical driver would probably be someone who doesn't have that raw natural talent of the car control. Of course, they got to have it, but like they're probably also really like thinking about, you know, looking at track maps, mapping out exactly where they're going to apex and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Instinctual is like less focused on shaving tenths off by like correcting something. And
it's like Prost versus Senna.
Yes. And yeah, like at this time, I think Nicky was one of those guys that was like, he's obviously silver spoon kind of dude who could just like not buy his way in, but the money certainly helped him get into the sport. But he did have that talent to back it up. At this time in Formula One, especially in the early years, like there were still just a lot of dudes that were silver spoon, but didn't necessarily have that talent, you know? Mm-hmm. But they were able to keep the car on track.
Yeah, they weren't necessarily like, and it's still sort of this way, but like not necessarily the greatest driver in the world, but the greatest rich guy drivers in the world.
Right, yeah. Right. Exactly.
It's like if a basketball cost $300 million.
Yeah. All right. So now Nicky's that Ferrari. He's getting a shot thanks to his family's financial support and his true talent for driving, a combination of wealth and skill that has become a predictable pattern when it comes to racing at the highest level. Still, despite his wealth, Nicky had a relatively simple life, especially at a time when Formula One was known for drivers who partied like rock stars off the track. Nicky was an introvert in a sport that was at the time largely defined by its extroverts and larger-than-life personalities.
That's a good point. I feel like I could not see Lewis Hamilton Instagramming him partying like all night. Like he's just like always like doing something really healthy.
Yeah.
Training. Max Verstappen like would not see him at a club just like
no
shouting.
Ironically, the only person I can picture on the grid right now that would be like posting
parties on his story would be like someone like Kimi Raikkonen, the oldest driver on the grid.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, back to Nicky. Although Ferrari was a big-time team with budgets and egos to match, the first half of the 70s had been a rough go for the Ragazzi in Red. Their decision to hire the little-known Lauda, who hadn't even come close to an F1 podium, seemed like a pretty odd gamble. But Enzo proved that he knew what he was doing. At 78 years old, Ferrari was still a fearsome patriarch who demanded excellence from his team. In Nicky's debut at the Argentina Grand Prix, Lauda immediately lived up to Enzo's expectations, placing second behind only Denny Hulme of McLaren. It was an immediate breakthrough that showed Nicky had finally truly arrived on the F1 scene. But before we go any further, I think we should talk about Nicky's role in developing the Ferrari, helping them go from middling success to getting that second place finish. Joe, in the movie Rush, which you love so much, there's that famous scene of Nicky test driving the car at Maranello. What does Nicky say about the Ferrari?
He says, oh, my Alberto. I can't remember what he said.
He says, you know, the mechanic asks him, hey, how's the car feel? And he says, he tells the mechanic to his face, the car shit.
That scene. Yeah. I thought you were talking about the scene where he is saying, oh boy, Alberto. That's a different one.
According to an interview Niki Lauda gave, I can't remember with who, it was actually Ferrari's son, Dino, that had asked him what he thought of the car.
And that's a, you know, blasphemy at Ferrari. You never talk shit about the car. You get a freaking ruler to the wrist for that.
Yeah, so Nicky said to Dino, hey, like, this car is shit. Enzo Ferrari did not speak English, but he knew enough. And Enzo came over and was like, what does Nicky think about the car? And Dino was a little hesitant to say. And then Nicky was like, the car is shit. And then Enzo was like, the car is shit, huh? And Nicky Lauda, there was like a long silence. Nicky says that it was like the longest 30 seconds of his life. Which in retrospect, like...
Yeah, the guy's had some long 30-second
Yeah, stints. So that means a lot. Ferrari, Enzo actually responded. He's like, okay, why is it shit? And then Nicky explains that the car understeers a lot, doesn't want to, like, turn in at speed. So Enzo asks Nicky, like, how much faster does he think the car could go around Maranello if the understeer is fixed? And Nicky says, you know, maybe 3 to 5 tenths. And then Enzo's like, okay, we'll fix the car. And if you don't go 5 tenths faster, you're fired.
Whoa.
And Nick is like, oh. He's like, in the interview, he's like, I think I made a mistake. 3 days go by. The engineers have like worked on the car. Nicky takes it out at Maranello once again and goes 8 tenths faster.
Oh, okay, cool. He still got fired, though, because he didn't hit exactly 5 tenths.
No, come on, Joe. Yeah, so he goes 8 tenths faster. And Nicky says that after that, that's when Enzo respected him. Enzo didn't really take a lot of gruff like that, but if someone could back it up and prove him wrong and make the car better, I think rightly so, that deserves some respect. Yeah. Anyway, after the Argentine Grand Prix, 3 races later, Nicky was driving in the rain and lapped the entire field to win his first race at the Spanish Grand Prix. It was a bit of redemption, not just for Nicky, but Ferrari, who incredibly hadn't won a race since 1971.
Whoa.
Insane. The Ferrari was fast, and Lauda was fast, too. And over the course of the season, he earned pole position in 6 of the 15 races. But still, Nicky was adjusting to his third team in as many seasons, and he had a series of retirements that led him to finishing in 4th place for the season at Ferrari. Nicky had proven not only did he deserve the spot at Ferrari, he also deserved to be paid for that spot.
This blows my mind that these guys weren't getting paid.
It's that same thing when you find out that many, many actors in Hollywood are all parents of like producers or other successful people. It's like you can afford to do this stuff when you don't have to worry about paying your rent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also notable was Nicky's dedication to working with team engineers to incrementally test and improve his cars. Although it seems like a very obvious process now, in those days of Formula One, not all drivers were so dedicated. They figured they were there to just show up on race day and drive fast. Nicky put everything he had into his preparation, and it showed. And Joe, I think that's another aspect of that technical versus instinctual driver.
Yeah, just like preparation, studying the course.
Understanding like how a car works, understanding what adjustments on the car do.
Yeah.
The better a driver is, and this is across all motorsports, the better a driver is at communicating how the car feels around track and even offering suggestions on how to adjust the car to the mechanics, like,
yeah,
the better.
That's a technical driver.
That's a technical driver. Anyway, 1975 was the year all the hard work paid off, resulting in what Nicky called his, quote, dream year. Ferrari and Nicky had worked together to tune the Ferrari 312T to near perfection, and the car would remain in use by Ferrari until 1981, eventually becoming the winningest car in F1 history. For his part, Nicky was easily the winningest driver of 1975, triumphing in 5 of 14 contests. Only one other driver, Emerson Fittipaldi, even managed to win 2 races, and in the end, Nicky had an insurmountable 20-point lead in the standings. Among his many accomplishments for the year, Nicky became the first ever driver to lap the Nürburgring in less than 7 minutes. The triumph foreshadowed how Nicky's racing legacy would forever be shaped by the dauntingly epic German track. The next season, in 1976, the Nürburgring would be the setting for one of the most shocking moments in F1 history, not to mention Nicky's own life story.
We'll be right back with more of this story, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
We should mention that 1975, the season we just talked about, Nicky won his first championship.
By 20 points.
By 20 points. He said that this was his hardest fought championship, at least at that point, obviously.
It was part of Nicky's nature not to be satisfied with a single championship. He was determined to defend his title, make his great-grandpa look like a jerk. But more than anything, he was focused on outperforming himself. In the off-season, he spent a grueling 6 hours a day running, swimming, and cycling to increase his mental and physical strength. Unheard of conditioning for an F1 driver of the time.
I got to get into that so I can be at the top of my YouTube game, dude.
This is like back in the day when people were drinking whiskey and eating steaks for lunch.
Yeah.
Enter James Hunt, a devilishly handsome Brit with long blonde hair and a crooked smile. James was incredibly charismatic, known as much for his partying off the track as he was for his performance on it. It was rumored that he had slept with 35 British Airways stewardesses over the course of a single race week. His playboy reputation masked the fact that behind the mop of beautiful blonde hair, the cigarettes and the liquor, or the babes on his arm, was an incredibly fierce competitor. 1976 was James's first year with McLaren after a strong performance at Hesketh. Alistair Caldwell, the manager of McLaren, recalled when James sat in the cockpit of the car for the first time, even though it wasn't yet turned on, the car was vibrating. shaking with James's nervous energy. On the surface, Nikki and James couldn't be more different. Because of Nikki's mullet and overbite combo, Lauda was openly referred to by James and others as Rat. A nickname, like many nicknames, was partially loving, partially insulting. Over the years it evolved, many fans referred to Nikki as Super Rat or Rat King. The two struck up an unlikely friendship. Nikki didn't threaten James, who valued his looks and could be confident he would always be the prettiest race car driver in the room. Of Nikki, James would say, quote, "Although we appear on the outside to be very different people, I get on very well with him. We share the same view of life and the same goals." Of course, the similar goal was to win at F1. For all their camaraderie off the track, both drivers brought enormous egos and competitive spirit to every race. In 1976, McLaren were in many ways the underdog. Ferrari had a longer history and a bigger budget. With that came a bit of arrogance. Alistair Caldwell described the team of the time as incredibly Italian, leaving you to fill in the blanks. Of course, that ignored the fact that the team's star driver was not Italian at all, but a serious, laser-focused Austrian known as Niki Lauda. The season started at Interlagos in Brazil, where Lauda got off to a great start, securing the win. As the season continued, it wasn't clear there would be any sort of rivalry between Ferrari and McLaren, as Lauda performed strongly and got out to a solid lead in points. Ferrari's luck would change in Spain. Before the race, Lauda fell off a tractor at his home and broke several ribs. James saw his opportunity, figuring he'd win the race handedly, and he did. When asked how he accomplished the win, James responded, "I got big balls. Two of them. They live between my legs.
Shiny eggs."
Those big balls would retract in the post-race review, however, as in a first of Formula One, Hunt's win was disqualified, stunning the race crews and the public. Apparently, it had been ruled that McLaren's car was a centimeter, that is 0.39 inches, too wide. It was a shady ruling that foreshadowed FIA's infamous favoritism of Alan Prost over Ayrton Senna a decade later. Alistair Caldwell of McLaren speculated that since the race judges had inspected the car in advance of the race, they had full knowledge of the grounds for disqualification.
Yeah, what the hell?
But chose to wait until after the race to disqualify Hunt. Ruling meant that Lauda was now ahead 33-6 in points. At the next race, James Hunt showed he wasn't taking it too seriously, polishing a bumper sticker affixed to the spoiler of his McLaren that read, "Caution, wide vehicle."
I mean, that's pretty funny.
Weeks later, the points from the race would be reinstated following a review, but it was clear that James Hunt had no friends in Formula One executive offices. Halfway through the season was the British Grand Prix. Now, at this point, James Hunt was a media phenomenon in his home country, and he brought out a massive sold-out crowds to Brands Hatch. Many in attendance had never before taken an interest in F1. The race was as chaotic as the stands, with Clay Regazzoni, Nikki's Ferrari teammate, accidentally colliding with the rear of Nikki's car, sending them both spinning out in front of a crowded field. James was among the drivers caught up in the mayhem, and his car skipped over a curb and flew into the air. Like the tomcat that he was, he managed to land flat on his wheels, speeding off to the pits.
What? Yeah, he did a full flip and landed on his wheels? Man, those are big, shiny, smooth balls.
The race was slated for a restart, but it was rumored James's car wouldn't be allowed to join. The British crowd became riled up, chanting, "We want James! We want James! We're hooligans! We will throw bottles at you! We love the Queen, and we love James!" They booed at the marshals and tossed beer cans onto the track. McLaren, scrambling to repair James's car in time, benefited from the delay. Nikki was furious that McLaren had bought the extra time. When the restart finally happened, Nikki took off in first, but James was able to tail him closely. About halfway through, he passed, making the crowd go even crazier than they had before. James won the race. It seemed like the season wasn't over after all. However, trouble once again lurked after the race. Ferrari and other teams disputed James's win, arguing that since he'd taken a shortcut to the pit before the restart, he hadn't raced the full race distance, and that the marshals had only allowed him to race out of fear of the crowd. No decision was yet made, but the race would come back later in the season to haunt James.
Man, there's so much pettiness in F1.
It's so just like a misunderstanding. Like, the fans don't want this.
Yeah.
You understand? Like, at the end of the day, this is entertainment for the people, right? This isn't about you. It's about us, and we don't freaking want this crap.
Earlier in the season, the F1 Drivers Union had held a meeting in Long Beach, back when they raced at Long Beach, which they should do again.
Everyone meet at Wahoo's. We're going to go over the rules for next season.
The topic was the increasingly powerful F1 cars that were becoming more and more of a safety concern. Especially worrisome for the drivers was the Nürburgring and whether it could host the new F1 cars safely. The track itself was 23 kilometers long, or about 12 miles, meaning, counting both sides of the track, there was 46 kilometers of barriers and such to be kept safe and staffed with emergency personnel. That's a lot of area to cover. 140 people had been killed on the track since 1927. Nikki was among those, arguing that it was too dangerous, but by a 3-2 vote, he was overruled. Now, the next race after Britain was the German Grand Prix at the Nürburgring, and Nikki had no choice but to compete. There were bad vibes from the start, okay, guys? The Sunday before the race, a fan had come up to Nikki and asked for an autograph. Nikki signed it, thinking nothing of it, but the fan wasn't done. He asked Nikki to put the date next to the autograph. Nikki had never been asked to date his autograph before, and so he asked why. The answer the fan gave him was chilling. Quote, because it could be the last one.
That's a messed up thing to do as a fan.
Even if that's why, you don't tell him. You're like, I don't know, in case you win, I want a proof that it was today.
Yeah, that's messed up, dude.
That guy's a sociopath.
Yeah.
In case it's the last one.
Yeah. Yeah, who is this guy? Willem Dafoe in, like, Platoon?
I come for the mayhem.
Why are you laughing so much?
Yeah, this is... what a creep, dude. The race started in rainy conditions. All but one driver, Jochen Mass of McLaren, started on wet tires. I don't know what Jochen was thinking. As the race got underway, the sun came out, and Jochen actually took the lead because the track was drying up. I guess he got the call right.
That's what he was thinking.
That's what he was thinking, Nolan. It was clear the other drivers would have to switch to have a chance at catching up. Nikki had switched to his smooth, dry tires, but they were cold, and he struggled to get them up to temperature. It was a dangerous situation in the section of the track that were still damp. There are tons of trees at the Nürburgring, so there's probably a lot of shady spots that kept it from drying up. And given the length of the Nürburgring, the damp sections were numerous and impossible to get a feel for lap to lap. On a left-handed curve of the track, Nikki came too close to the curb on the inside corner. His left rear tire clipped it, causing the rear tires of his F1 car to skid out right, causing a bit of oversteer. He corrected, but overly so, which sent the car's rear veering wide to the left. So the he's correcting, he catches the slide, but then...
Like oversteer?
Yeah, so he's skidding out until he's at a right angle to the track. He's drifting. His car slams into the guardrail, which blocked the cars from flying into the woods. Nikki's car instantly erupts into flames, parts fly everywhere, and his car slides back onto the track. He's in the middle of the track, his car's on fire, and he's trapped inside of it. Guy Edwards, a driver trailing Nikki, was able to dodge the wreck, but the next car wasn't as lucky. Driver Brett Lunger drove directly into Nikki's flaming Ferrari with a sickening crunch. There was a secondary explosion of leaking fuel. The drivers involved leapt out of their cars and pulled Nikki from the wreckage as the flames and black smoke poured out of the now molten hot Ferrari. I think Nikki was in the car for about a minute. It's not like they could just easily grab Nikki right away. And they're just, they approach the car. And I mean, it's a massive fireball at this point. So they're not really sure what to do. They're like calling over safety workers, but of course the track is so long, so the workers aren't able to get there as quickly. It was Hans Stuck driving for the March team, whose quick actions may not have saved Nikki's life, but saved him from further agony. As the ambulance approached, he waved for the vehicle to break protocol and drive against traffic towards the site of the accident, saving as much as an hour of time.
Whoa.
I think that was the right call.
Yeah.
Because of his fellow driver's valiant efforts, Nicky was alive, but only barely. Nicky described his memories of his waking moments following the crash, quote, "You realize that you are getting weaker and weaker and feel that it would be best to let go of everything, to let yourself fall as if into a deep hole or well. But at the same time, you try to react. You try to do everything you can so you don't die."
God, that's brutal.
I think that's probably the best. I mean, I've never had a near-death experience, but I think that's the best description of death I've ever read.
I've never been at that point, but I definitely feel what he's feeling.
After he was flown to the hospital, his condition was touch and go. The race had resumed at the Nürburgring, and James Hunt had prevailed, but the rivalry seemed like something from a lifetime ago. On his hospital bed, a delirious Niki Lauda asked a visiting Daniel Audetto, Ferrari's team manager, the keys to his rental car. Out of his mind on drugs, he conducted a phone interview for a Brazilian radio station, something that years later he would have no memory of. At the hospital, Niki was wrapped from head to toe in bandages. His nose and his steely blue eyes, now misted over with drugs, the only part of his body visible. Fumes from the melted car had poisoned his lungs. Nurse asked him if he wished to receive his last rites, and he said yes, figuring it couldn't do any harm.
Might as well, just in case, you know.
Niki waited in silence before realizing that the priest, figuring he was unconscious, was delivering the prayer in silence. Niki was upset, but forever with a chip on his shoulder, it made him determined to fight on despite the perceived slight.
That's also so funny.
This guy. Also a comfort was Nikki's wife, Marlena. Although Niki could not speak, she sat by his side and spoke to him for hours. So Niki talks about, in this interview that I watched, he talks about how the doctors, quote, vacuumed his lungs out. So they would use a little suction hose to like get all of like the, like there was just like carbon from all the smoke in there that was like clogging everything up. There was like, he said, plastic pieces, bits of plastic and rubber in his lungs as well. Like, it's a miracle that he survived.
Yeah. It's a miracle that he lived to be 70.
Yeah, that's crazy. Too.
Yeah. That's why you and you're like 70 too young was like, that. I think I made it pretty far, considering.
Yeah. Fair enough. We'll get back to more Pass Gas, but right now, a word from our sponsors.
Thankfully, it soon became clear that Nicky's recovery was headed in the right direction. The doctors attributed it to Nicky's iron will. It also helped that the Austrian had been leading a much healthier lifestyle than the average person of the time. Concerned when he read headlines about Nicky in a coma, a friend called the hospital where Nicky was recovering, only to find a lucid and distinctly uncomatose Nicky happy to chat on the other end of the line.
Oh yeah, I'll take the call.
Once he was able to leave the hospital, Nicky took up residence at a luxury hotel in the Alps to rehabilitate himself with the help of Willy Dungel, an Austrian fitness guru. He took his first press conference, walking into a room of photographers eager to get photos of Nicky's wounds. Still in bandages, and with his upper half of his right ear melted away, Nicky faced the crowd of journalists bravely. The first question was cruel. How did it feel to have such an unnatural face?
My God.
Jesus Christ.
Nicky replied, "What's unnatural? It's just a piece of my natural thigh in my face." That's so cool. The next question. What does your beautiful wife, Marlena, have to say about how you look now?
God, shut up.
There didn't seem to be any empathy for what Nicky had suffered. Nicky left the press conference shocked. He turned to his manager and said, "Did you see how crazy they are about my burnt face? From now on, we charge double." It was a sardonic type of humor that Nicky would wear as a kind of armor in the decades that followed. When asked by an interviewer how his face looked after the accident, he said, "Huge and burnt." And reflected that while I definitely look different than I did before, some people are born less beautiful than I am now. At least I have an excuse with the accident. Another protective piece of gear would be a ubiquitous baseball hat that he'd wear in nearly every public appearance, partially covering the scar tissue that now covered most of his scalp and forehead.
Yeah, in that interview, he said that the cap is like a protection from stupid people looking at me stupidly, is one way to say it. The first time he looked at himself in the mirror, you know, I think I'd be like, geez, like I'd be despondent probably. But Nikki, like, I think this part of that, like that steely Austrian stoicism, he's just like, well, like he said to himself, like, and my face is f***ed up.
Like, well, he wasn't like super, you know, handsome before. I feel like he had spent his whole life kind of building up this defense of, you know, snark.
Yeah.
For people who called him ugly or called him a rat or whatever.
Yeah. Anyway, he said to himself, well, you know what? Like, thank God I'm alive. It is what it is. And that's just what, let's go from there, you know? Of course, while Nikki's physical recovery was incredible, it was the mental component of strapping back into an F1 cockpit that was perhaps even more impressive. After missing only 2 races, 6 weeks later, Lauda was slated to return at the Italian Grand Prix at Monza, like I said, just 6 weeks after the accident. As much as Brands Hatch was James Hunt's home turf, Monza, House of Ferrari, was the adoptive home of Niki Lauda. James's first line upon seeing Niki was, quote,
Niki, you're the only person I know who can come out of fire and look better looking.
Insane. Other drivers criticized Ferrari's decision to hire a third driver for the season, forcing Niki to race out of fear that he would lose his spot. Still, Carlos Rutem, Niki's teammate at Ferrari, was amazed at his recovery, saying, quote, it's very impressive that after such a short time, Niki is so fit and keen on driving. Fit was maybe going a little too far. Just like at Nürburgring, this race was rainy and a chilling reminder of the last time Niki had been at the track. As Niki sat down behind the wheel for the first time since his accident, he was suddenly emotionally overwhelmed by the events of the last four weeks. All of it came flashing back. The sudden and fiery crash at Nürburgring, the weeks spent in a hospital bed, the loss of skin and his ear, the skin transplants, the rehabilitation, and the flash of camera bulbs as the media closed in. He did one slow lap, then went back to the pits. He got out of his car and regrouped. Once he got back in, he decided that he had to race for himself. Having missed 2 races, Niki now had to finish and get points in order to stay in contention for the championship. James Hunt and McLaren had once again run into rules trouble, this time for allegedly using, quote, illegal fuel, and had been forced to start at the back of the grid. A frustrated Hunt tried to charge through the pack but spun out, prompting cheers from the Ferrari-backing Italian crowd known as the Tifosi. James's day had ended with jeers from the crowd as he jogged back to the pits. A nervous Marlena watched from the crowd as Niki raced. Even without his main rival in the race, nerves were high. Incredibly, Niki placed 4th and was given a standing ovation by the crowd. Upon finishing, he was mobbed by teammates and bystanders who just wanted to congratulate him, not only for staying in contention for the championship, but simply for returning to racing.
I mean, a month is like, you're still probably wearing bandages and you've still probably got plasma gooey. Leaking from your skin.
His wounds had not healed all the way, and his fire hood got like soaked with blood after the race.
Yeah, all I can think about is how bad your helmet would hurt.
Oh yeah.
Ah, man.
Like, helmets are uncomfortable anyway. The next season turned to North America for the Canadian Grand Prix. Before that, however, the Formula One Commission met to decide on the British Grand Prix. They ruled that James was indeed disqualified from the British Grand Prix that he had won, causing him to lose all 9 points. McLaren lost their sights on the season. James decided to say screw it and party upon landing in Toronto. The entire McLaren team, dejected and probably a little bitter, partied at the hotel bar, where a cover band led by a Stevie Nicks lookalike played into the night. That's so sweet. The next morning, James showed up severely hungover. The singer at his side.
No way.
She's not Stevie, but she'll do.
Yeah, like James Hunt probably could have like slept with the real Stevie Nicks.
Yeah.
That's just such a sign. Like, yeah, I'm pretty sad.
Yeah, I do this to take my mind off my feelings.
I'm not emotionally healthy.
I've got nice blonde hair, though. Can I have a water bottle?
Can I have a frigging Gatorade or something? Maybe a bacon, egg, and cheese.
After his bacon, egg, and cheese, he hit the track and unbelievably, after the night he had, won the race.
Whoa.
The unexpected win meant that the championship was still in play for both McLaren and Ferrari. At the next race, the U.S. Grand Prix, Hunt won again, putting him only 3 points back. It all came down to the 1976 Japanese Grand Prix, the final race of the season. The two drivers were separated by only 3 points, meaning that winning the race for either competitor would win the season. On race day, a heavy downpour delayed the event. Many of the drivers argued with F1 leadership that the race should be called off. Even James Hunt, who needed a chance at points to win the championship, wanted it to be called off. The delay reached 2 hours when abruptly the organizers announced the race would start after all, although the rain had not abated. The reason? The race was the first ever to be broadcast on satellite, and the organizers were worried that if they were called off, they would lose daylight, making broadcasting the event impossible. It all came down to money. As the race began, the cars sent up giant plumes of water, reducing visibility for everyone except the lead driver, James Hunt. Brambilla, the March driver, attempted to pass James but spun out. Nicky, lagging behind, made a momentous decision. Only 2 laps in, he pulled into the pits. He felt that the conditions made racing safely impossible. In his words, "My life is worth more than a title." A shocked Daniele Audetto, the team manager, recalled seeing terror in Nicky's eyes as he exited the car. He asked Nicky if he wanted to claim a technical failure to save face. Nicky said no. Tells him the truth. Too dangerous to race. Meanwhile, James Hunt raced on. He had to place third or better to win the championship. As the track dried, McLaren team worried that James's wet weather tires would overheat. They put out a sign for him to purposefully drive through the wetter part of the track on the straightaway, which would help them cool. But James was either oblivious or ignored the team's pleas. With 5 laps left, James was forced to the pits. With not one but 2 flat tires, he rejoined the race in 5th place, needing to regain 2 spots. Hunt charged aggressively. Incredibly, he did exactly what he needed to do, placing 3rd and becoming world champion. Amazingly, as the race ended, James was confused and thought that he had come in 4th. He pulled into the pits and began to rage at his team in frustration. They eventually calmed him down enough for him to realize that he was the champion. James was magnanimous in victory, saying, "I feel sorry for Nicky. I wanted to win the championship, and I felt I deserved to win the championship. I also felt Nicky deserved to win the championship, and I just wish that we could have shared it, you know, like tied for first, like both gone out and just gone at the exact same time." Like in Ford versus Ferrari.
That's a movie that's going to come out in 45 years.
That's a movie that's going to come out in 45 years. If you like this movie that I'm currently making.
That was the weirdest part about Rush, is when it got really meta. He started talking to the camera.
He said, "Hey, I'm Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah, check out Thor."
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that just shows that, like, these guys, they're, you know, fierce rivals, but, you know, on the field of battle, your biggest enemy can become your biggest friend.
We've said it a bunch on this show. It's like, at a certain point, when you're just this elite type of person, you know, you're just at the top of this mountain. The only people that truly understand you and that you truly understand are up on the top of that mountain with you.
Nicky was one of the least photogenic drivers in Formula. I feel like that's a just... What the Yeah. He wasn't good looking, so what? But ironically, he had helped usher in the modern era of F1 as a global television event, giving home audiences their first taste of an exciting season-long F1 rivalry. Without both him and James, F1 would probably not be what it is today. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. After 1976, James Hunt never won a championship again and retired in 1979. Yeah, from there, he went to broadcast for the BBC, but unfortunately, he died in his sleep of a heart attack in 1993 at age 45.
Oh, man, so yeah. Young.
For his part, Nicky proved that his accident at the Nürburgring had barely slowed him down. After all, if he hadn't been forced to miss those two races, it would have been him, not James, who was champion in 1976. It took him only a year to win a second championship at Ferrari, and from there he raced for Brabham and then McLaren. He took a little hiatus, actually, took a few years off, and then went to McLaren, his former rival. It was then, in 1983, that he won his third world title, prevailing over his teammate, Alain Prost, becoming the only driver to win a championship for both Ferrari and McLaren. And I think it's also worth mentioning that six-year gap between 77 and 83, like, that's not something a lot of drivers can claim. That's a pretty big gap.
Yeah. There's a lot of, like, technological advances that happened during that time, too. It's like being a TikTok star in 2015 and then trying to come back in 2021. You have to relearn all the new dances.
Mm-hmm. You do.
All the new lip syncs.
Yeah, you do.
Well, it's like very few people are able to make the transition from Vine to TikTok.
Yeah.
He took off 3 years between 79 and 82. I don't want to be too bold, okay? But the only driver right now who could have a similar sort of comeback like that would be Fernando Alonso, who's coming back this year.
I thought you were going to say Grosjean.
Grosjean he's not in Formula One for the prospective future. But we got Alonso coming back this season at Renault. We might see some. I don't know. It'd be quite the sight. Anyway, even as a champion, Nicky was critical of the hype around Formula One. In his words, quote, "I think Formula One is often overrated by the fans who come to the Grand Prix and the media. Formula One should not be this way. It's just the fact that there are 26 more or less crazy drivers going around in circles for their own pleasure. It's given too much significance."
It's kind of true.
I love it. I don't know if I agree, but I love that. That's awesome. After Formula One, Nicky said, quote, "I became more human. I lost my blinkers and my singular, brutal focus on winning a race. My view of life became broader. I don't think I can completely lose my egotism, but I could reduce it to a level where my fellow human beings, especially my wife, did not have to suffer anymore."
So that's just like exactly what you would imagine a sociopath to say. Like, I understand I'm a piece of shit. And I guess now that I'm not on top of the world, I can, like, be a normal person.
Did we mention it in the script? But anyway, his ex-wife Marlena said in an interview that, like, Nicky was an asshole when he was racing.
Yeah. He's the worst asshole. And he agreed.
After retiring, Nicky focused on the airline that he had founded in 1979, known as Lauda Air. At one point, the airline had as many as 66 planes in its fleet. Nicky had sold his shares in 1999 to Austrian Air, making a rich man even richer. For much of the lifetime of the airline, he was a pilot himself, logging over 13,000 hours in the sky. He also had his own. He still had a private jet, a Bombardier, that he would fly to races in himself. He didn't want to rely on airlines. Even as he managed an airline and worked as a pilot, Nicky also agreed to management roles on various F1 teams. And in 2012, Lauda would make his mark as a non-executive chairman for the Mercedes-AMG Petronas team. He was part of the negotiations to sign Lewis Hamilton to his initial three-year contract with the team, the beginning of a relationship that spawned the most successful dynasty in F1 history. On May 20th, 2019, Niki Lauda passed away at age 70 from complications related to his kidneys. To honor him, Mercedes painted their halo red with writing that read, "Nicky, we miss you." His funeral was attended by Lewis Hamilton, Alain Prost, Jackie Stewart, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and a host of other dignitaries from the F1 community and beyond. It was always a joy to see Nicky get, like, interviewed after Lewis won.
Yeah, that was a really fun part of seeing that team operate.
And at the, I think it was 2019, Monaco Grand Prix, like, everyone was wearing, like, a red hat that said Nicky on it.
Yeah, and then there was, like, the ceremony at the end where they all just, like, touched the hat on the pedestal.
Yeah.
That was cool.
He had one of his red helmets from his McLaren days. Super cool. Part of the appeal of driving cars and racing is the chance to transcend your human body. When you're behind the wheel of a massive vehicle, you feel like you're more than just flesh and bone. You gain the illusion that you're one with the car, part machine, that the wheels and the engine are an extension of your body. But that's just an illusion. Our human bodies are impossibly fragile and soft compared to the cars we drive. Whenever there's a big crash, like Romain Grosjean's dramatic near-death experience this past year in Bahrain, we're jolted out of our reverie and giving a shocking reminder of just how vulnerable we all are. Niki Lauda was a man who almost died, but lived. And he spent his second shot at life doing what he loved. That's what we should all be doing every day. Hopefully it's a lesson that doesn't take a fiery crash to learn. Wow. I've got such like a... Like I said, I always love seeing Niki Lauda's interviews after races, but like now I've got like such a just a refreshed appreciation for the man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great story.
He's super intelligent and just like self-aware. And even though he was an asshole, like that's kind of how you have to be like a 3-time world champ. You just have to kind of disregard your emotions and, you know, be the asshole, be the heel.
But he was also hilarious.
Yeah. He had really fun comebacks and kind of poke fun at himself a lot. And I think that's really cool.
Well, I think like, you know, it's especially because like his rivalry was with someone like James Hunt. I think like it's easy to present someone in like we said before, like a very black and white sort of one dimensional way, because that serves the story. It's like James Hunt is super charming and Niki Lauda is like this like Iceman asshole. You know, it's a little bit like Snake and Mongoose, where, you know, it's like, no, Niki was funny too.
Yeah.
And Niki was charming too. You know, it was easy to hate him because he had like a hateable accent and he was kind of I think he had fun with his character a little bit.
Yeah. You leaned into it.
Yeah.
That's the lesson, man. Lean into it.
Lean into it. If people call you a prick, just be a prick. Don't do that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to Pascast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did. Go ahead and tell someone about the podcast. Let them know that you don't have to be a fan of cars to like this show. You know, that's what it's all about.
Buy this new shirt. Pop-up headlight shirt.
Pop-up headlight shirt now available at donutmedia.com. Follow Nolan on social media. That's Twitter and Instagram at Nolan J. Sykes. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow me at James Pumphrey. Follow Donut at Donut Media.
Thank you to our writer, Thomas Ouellette, and our producer, Bridget. Couldn't do the show without the team. Keep it juiced. Be kind.
I love you.
See you next time.
All right.